and
oh, I'm. It's not that kind of podcast. I'll tell you the one I used today, but this is somebody else's podcast I'm doing. Sorry, I end my podcasts with a question for my daughter.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am absolutely delighted today because we have a very special guest. You know him from Arrested Development, Grammy Award winner, Emmy Award winner, contributor and writer for Tenacious D, writer, performer, stage, screen, the whole thing. David also has a fantastic podcast called Senses Working Overtime, and is currently on tour with the End of the Beginning of the End tour. Welcome, David. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to spending a half hour or so with you here. And I want to start out by asking you a question that I've noticed from working with folks in Hollywood entertainment over the last couple of decades. A lot of celebrities just absolutely these days are terrified of politics. They kind of want to hide their head in the sand about what's happening around them. You don't seem to have as much fear or difficulty with that as other folks.
No, I never have. I mean, that's been not something I've had to work at or anything like that. It's just the way I'm built, you know?
Right.
And yeah, I think people are, you know, there's always a handful of people who are vocal and a number of people who are not for various reasons. Usually, at least in the entertainment industry, they want to keep working. And sometimes they're just not as bothered. Sometimes, you know, they're not, they're blissfully ignorant, I'd say. And then sometimes people are, you know, I've certainly worked with a number of people who are pro right wing. I don't know about extremists, but they certainly are happy that,
yeah,
Trump or Bush or another Bush or president. So I don't know. I'm just not one of those people. And I always knew that when I was first starting out and I was working as a feature or a opener on the road.
Right.
And I always knew that the headliner was going to suck if I came off stage and they're like, man, kid, you got some guts. You got a lot of balls. So I knew, I was like, oh, well, you're probably not very good.
But I mean, as part of that fearlessness, just what stand-up requires, because I've always admired people who do stand-up, and you've been in the stand-up fight for a couple of decades now. You know the business. You've done this for a bit. Is that part of what you end up with, that you just sort of like, I'm going to walk in the room, I'm going to do my thing, fuck it?
Yeah, but to answer your first question, I don't think it's required to stand up. There's lots and lots and lots and lots of good stand up I love and admire and respect that is not political at all. It's not necessarily one's place to do that. I think it's a great place to do that. If you're of that mind, then you should be doing that. But I mean, there's 100 stand ups that I love that never talk politics. But for me, and also I'm not a by any stretch a political quote unquote comic. I'm a comic who does talk about topical stuff and religion and politics kind of gets in there. But it's not even half of what my set is. Not even.
Right.
Yeah.
You have kind of a narrative storytelling approach to this stuff, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you're not, it's not just bits. It's,
right.
You seem to have a more like I said, a narrative style. Maybe I'm using the wrong terms of art for comedy, but you don't, I know what I know. I don't know everything.
Rick, you need to download and watch my masterclass, clearly.
QED, obviously I do.
Yeah. But I also have lots of, you know, silly jokes. I have dad joke type shit.
Right.
You know, stuff that would make you roll your eyes, but it's funny to me. You know, I mean, I'm not above a pun. You know, I do that is kind of one of my strengths, is kind of a storytelling narrative type of thing. And I have plenty. In fact, the current tour, I'd say, might be the least political, although that may be changing in the coming days. But, you know, 30 minutes or at least 20 minutes of the opening half hour is about this one story that has nothing to do with politics, just an embarrassing situation I found myself in. So, yeah, you know.
Like I said, I've always admired people who do stand up, because I think some of the best of it is when you are kind of like not playing the character you play on TV, you know, if that makes sense. When you're I've seen comedians who are like honest about their fuck ups, their life, their the ups, the downs, all that stuff. I mean, does that vulnerability, or is that willingness to be able to tell the story of when you fucked up, as I like to call it, it's like my Tijuana story. If I tell my Tijuana story, it doesn't make me look like a hero. It makes me look like a dipshit, but it's kind of exciting and funny in that way.
Yeah. And you're a hero for telling it. So, you know, you're sometimes not a hero for the way you act in those moments, but if you relay this story, and yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that is present in good comedy, is just being vulnerable. And I think a key for really good stand-up is to look ugly, both physically and spiritually sometimes, you know. It's weird to see stand-ups who are like super cut, you know, or sexy stand-ups is something odd to me. Doesn't jive, doesn't compute.
So tell me your story. How did you get into comedy? What was your sort of like pathway into this whole place where you found yourself in as somebody who has done a lot of different angles and aspects of comedic performance? How did you start?
Well, I was the first time I did an open mic was the week before my 18th birthday in Atlanta, where I grew up, in the Punchline in Sandy Springs. And
okay, I know Sandy Springs. Yeah,
do you really?
Yeah, yeah.
I know Atlanta. I grew up in Roswell, so I was up the road.
Sure,
but so I knew early on that I wanted to do something that was, you know, part of the entertainment industry umbrella. So not specifically, but I was a huge Monty Python fan.
And same.
And you know, I moved around a lot every single year when I was a little kid, and then I was born in Atlanta, but then settled back there when I was 9, and you know, it was I was awkward. It was not a great time for me, and Roswell was a culture shock in the sense that it was very rural, suburban.
Sure. And back then, especially.
Back then, yeah, and separate from Atlanta. Now it's all one sprawling thing.
Right, yeah,
you know, it's all one, the same thing. But back then, it felt very, very separate. And you know, it was very white. It was very Southern Baptist, and I stood out just physically. I mean, my personality was different, and whatever. But the point of me saying that is that I found my like-minded friends, like every weirdo and nerd and outcast and geek and whatever does in that situation. And we would, like, some people were into, you know, weed, some people were into metal, or, you know,
right.
You know, different types of music. And we were comedy geeks, you know, and I'd watch SNL and we'd imitate things and we'd write fake newspapers and just all, it was all geared towards comedy. And then, you know, I found that I liked it and I was kind of good at it. And then I had like stand-up albums, right? I had music albums, but I also had, you know, Richard Pryor and Jonathan Winters and Steve Martin. And, you know, I just had comedy albums along with the Python and stuff like that. And then I just knew that that was probably the thing I wanted to do. And I started going to some open mic nights and watching people, and they were just terrible, like dumb, like really dumb. And I had that feeling of, oh, I can do this in a cocky way. And, you know, at first I wasn't right, but then I became right. I can do this. And I, not initially, but, you know, sticking with it. And I just loved it. And I loved I loved being able to fuck with the audience too, before they knew who I was. It's also a fun aspect of it.
You know, I think you and I are about the same age. And I think when you mentioned Monty Python, Monty Python used to come on when I was growing up in Tampa, Florida on the PBS station.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On Saturday nights.
That's right.
And that era of, for me, and, you know, like I said, I think we're about the same age. And my dad had things like Bob Newhart albums and Don Rickles albums, and National Lampoon was a big thing in my circle of guys. Yeah. I think there's a certain style of like a little self-critical but funny comedy that grew out of that whole that Python tonality of just like the world is absurd, the government is fucked, the world is fucked. Laugh through it, because you know they could take the most absurd situation and make it into something that was relatable to British culture. And do we have the same thing these days? Do we have anybody that's like that these days in America? I can't think of anybody that has that irreverence. I don't think SNL really does the same kind of thing.
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, there's nothing quite like, you know, but Python was also contextually important, not just,
yes,
you know, it was a very kind of, especially British culture was stuffy, and they hadn't even, I mean, it was like, and as a kid, I didn't get probably half the references.
That oh, God, no.
Specific, but I got the idea, like, oh, this is a government employee. I didn't know who the real person that was modeled after was.
Right.
And I didn't know what Yorkshire was like, but I could certainly imagine, oh, okay, it must be like, you know, it must be like this Pittsburgh or whatever, you know. So I got that kind of the human aspect of it, but I don't know if there's anybody doing quite that thing.
Is it harder now in this incredibly divided country to do that kind of cultural comedy these days? Because I feel like everybody gets easily offended on both sides of the equation by comedy in a way they might not have 20 years ago.
I think that people do get offended more easily and are more vocal about it, but I don't think that has anything to do with why there isn't that kind of... I think there is somebody out there. There's a group of amazing writer performers, and they haven't gotten their shot because some executive somewhere was like, we don't want to get in hot water. Perhaps, I don't know if that's the case. But I just don't know. And I don't know what that thing would look like. I mean,
I'm kind of, it's an open question. I don't have an answer in my own head. I'm just sort of curious about it because I feel like we've gotten less tolerant on both sides of like a little bit of good natured fun with each other on every side of the political divide.
Yeah, sure. But let's be fair to that idea, which is something like, Don Rickles, you know, good natured fun has turned,
right.
There are people who are multimillionaires now and have been rewarded and successful, and their comedy isn't good-natured fun. It's like really sour and mean, and it's still kind of funny. It's in the world of, you know, I'm being funny, but there's a meanness to it that I don't think was tolerated before, but I also don't remember. I mean, there's a difference between Don Rickles and people of that era, that idea, right. Like, yeah, there's Puerto Ricans going like this, whatever, and
right,
and some of the stuff that is Rose. All right, my dog has decided to join us.
Lucky you, I've got my cat doing the same thing. It's the supervillain hour with Elton.
Wait, yeah, your cat is in the 65-pound puppy who doesn't understand boundaries yet.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, my dogs are luckily old, tired, and they sleep all day when they're not running around outside. We'll be right back. And now, back to the show. Yeah, so, I mean, I do think, though, I mean, culture needs comedy, though, right? I mean, we need it in our cultures.
I do.
Like, our need humor. They need comedy. They need relief valves. They need ways for society to not kill each other.
Well, it's and beyond that, at least what comedy did for me, speaking solely from my experience, but is to educate and inform and to show different perspectives. And, you know, I mean, Voltaire, I mean, that's going way back, but that's some funny shit, and it's really you know, important and shaped my way of thinking, and just as much as somebody like Lenny Bruce or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, it can educate as well.
Yeah, I'm as a boring classics guy, I love like all those Restoration comedies, Sheridan and Goldsmith and all those things, because you could rewrite them for today. They got that society has these sort of tropes that play over and over again between men and women, between rich and poor people, between classes, between race, all that stuff. But to me, it's always been like a steam valve. It's always been like a way to code for what society's thinking about or worried about or doing, in a way that lets you do it with a laugh, lets you do it without like it being overly, like the overly serious contemplation of our doom, which I think is very frequent right now, mm-hmm. for good reasons, folks. I mean, don't mistake me, everybody. I'm not taking the moment lightly, but I mean, there are things about this moment that are inadvertently funny. I mean, we are being ruled in this country by complete goons, mm-hmm. and
also it's
there are things about it that are comedic.
Yes, I mean, yeah, the cabinet is if you were to make a comedy movie and I'm not even trying to be funny, and I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. If you were to write the comic, the people that would serve in the cabinet, it's pretty much everybody Trump, even going back to, you know, Betsy DeVos as the I mean that one was like, oh, perfect, of course, that's what you would write. You would write
on the nose
Pete Hegseth, you would write Matt Gaetz, you would write, but I mean, obviously it's not funny because this isn't fiction, but yeah, you would just pick these clowns, and they are it is a clown show, but it has real world, effects, and, you know, people are gonna die, and so it's not that funny, but it is pretty much how you would script it.
I can't remember who wrote it, but one day someone said, even gallows humor is still humor.
Yeah.
You know, even gallows humor is still funny at times. And you know, it's that old scene from the movie where the guy's got the noose around his neck. He's looking at as the other guy and goes, first time. So, you know, growing up in Atlanta, it was a very different place at that point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, did you take any of the Southern sensibility out of Atlanta into your comedy as you grew up?
Not sensibility so much as just observations that I made. I mean, I rejected a lot of it out of a immature, you know, rebellion against having to be there, and I was miserable. I was suicidal. I mean, I hated. I was going to quit school, run away to New York. I mean, I was miserable. People there were. I got picked on a lot. It wasn't a good place for me to be. Then, when I was older, I auditioned for and got into the School of the Arts, and we moved into town, and that was a lifesaver. I mean, truly a lifesaver, I think. And I was much happier. I'm sorry, I forgot your question, Rick.
I was talking about, did you pull any of that sort of, because Atlanta at that time still was sort of the capital of the South.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And I was curious if you drawn any sort of the sensibility of that. Was there anything from that moment? Because my memories of Atlanta at that time, it was like starting to expand and grow. You know, it was that city too busy to hate vibe, the whole thing. I was just curious if that had, how that had influenced your writing or your comedy coming up.
I mean, honestly, it was just like, it informed kind of characters I did, but it wasn't, I don't think I took that to heart. I do, you know, when I go home, I'm home a lot, and, you know, everybody except one sister who's in North Carolina is still back in Atlanta, and I'm there, you know, easily four times a year. Especially now I've got a daughter, and I've still got a lot of friends there. And I wouldn't call it Southern sensibility outside of the artistic community, which is Southern, and I have a real affinity for kind of those artsy Southern, music and the arts in the South is different. It's the whole Athens scene back in the early 80s and the gay scene and everything was like kind of straight friendly gay scene and gay friendly straight scene and the intermingling of it, and then the shows and, you know, the bands and comedy. Cause again, I started doing stand up in Atlanta, and it was that kind of sensibility I took with me, and I still have, and I'm trying to, you know, I hope my daughter gets a sense of that, but it in the South, especially, it's kind of extra special.
We'll be right back. And now back to the show. Right, right. I mean, that's what I was trying to walk around to. I mean, I didn't ask the best question of it, but I have that same sort of sense of having grown up in the South, having there is a, it's not all the Northern cliche of what the South was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Right. But so you are known for Arrested Development, Tenacious D, Mr. Show. I mean, what's the project that you think shaped your career the most?
Oh, Mr. Show, I would say, mm-hmm. pretty easily, and shaped it in many ways, not just informed what I'd be doing, but that was the first time I ever produced anything.
Right.
And that's its own set of lessons you have to learn.
Right.
And And perhaps it's doing something like Mr. Show, which was Bob Odenkirk and I co-doing everything.
Right.
Made stand-up even more special because stand-up is one of the only things outside of maybe writing where it's just me. I don't take any notes from anybody. I mean, I can. I'm happy to listen.
Right.
some comments. But basically, it's just me standing up there. There's nothing to hide behind. There's no other person. It's just me. And it's not that kind of podcast. I'll tell you the one I used today. But this is somebody else's podcast I'm doing. Sorry, I end my podcasts with a question from my daughter. So I don't know if you heard her asking what
I did. I did. That was great.
So
that was great. You were talking about you're the only things that are really truly solo are writing and
stand-up. And I don't think I would have gotten nearly the opportunities I got if it hadn't been for Mr. Show. And Mr. Show is also, mm-hmm. I still run into people who. It's just one of those projects that I had so many that were important to me when I was a kid or teenager or, post-teen, whatever. But it was important to other people and not a ton of people know Mr. Show, but the ones who know it are seriously hardcore into it and have a deep right. appreciation for it. So...
Right.
In that sense, I would say Mr. Show.
Yeah, I mean, I think I remember Mr. Show as just something that was it was so tight and clever, and I really thought you hit something there that really worked. And of course, I mean, like I said. The inevitable, and when I was talking to other folks at Lincoln and working on the pregame for this today, everyone's like, ask about Arrested Development. We're all Arrested Development fans. I love it. That was a hell of an ensemble.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
That seems to me like a rare gift when you get that kind of a group of talent together.
Oh, it was the casting is amazing. And also, that was like, they got Michael Cera, Ali Shawkat. I mean,
yeah.
All these, Tony Hale, people weren't that familiar with.
Right.
Will Arnett. I mean, just the cream of the crops.
Yeah, that was as an ensemble piece. It, like watching you guys all working together in various permutations was just like.
Oh, so much fun.
This pros at the top of their game. You know, you got to appreciate that. So before we wrap up, I want to ask you a little bit. We started out talking about like whether we're in a moment where comedy is harder now because of the culture we live in and the moment we live in. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on now on the end of the beginning of the end tour.
Yep. Well, I took some time off. I toured a bunch in the States in September through, I guess, November. Or no, December 2. But anyway, and then took some time off because of the holidays, and my daughter was out of school. And then I just finished this little run on Broadway in the show called All In. And then I go to Canada on right in the beginning of March at some point, I want to say, the end of February. I'll be in Canada for 2 weeks. And then I go to Europe at the very end of March through April. I'll be in Europe for a month. Then do some more U.S. states, and then I'm going to tape the special at the 40 Watt in Athens.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I'll be doing two tapings of this show, and then that'll be that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, David Cross, I just want to thank you for coming on the show today. Folks, this wasn't as much of a political show as you might ordinarily have, but I was fascinated to talk to David because he is a man in full, to use a Southern phrase from Tom Wolfe.
Yep. Very good.
And I really appreciate you coming on today. And thanks again for listening to the LP podcast, folks. We'll see you again on the next episode.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Produced by Whitney Hayes. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.